In a revolution, dictators can fall, and so can money from tourism.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Good morning from APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Now the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world. Libya's leader Muammar Gaddafi continues hanging on to power as demonstrations go on now for a third week. And after the U.N. Security Council passed a resolution over the weekend ordering an arms embargo and freezing Gaddafi's assets. In Egypt today, the top prosecutor ordered the assets of the ousted president Hosni Mubarak to be frozen as well. The unrest in Egypt, though, a few weeks back sent more than a million tourists away from that country. From Cairo, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports on the effects that's having on the ground.
An old man in long robes and a turban plays the rabab, a little Egyptian stringed instrument. He hawks the rababs to tourists on a bridge over the Nile. But he's got no audience, and the commercial odds are against him. Way more sellers than buyers. Eric Bonmasson is a 22-year-old architecture student visiting from France. A few days ago, he went to the Great Pyramids at Giza.
We were nearly the only tourists, so we had all the pyramids for ourselves.
Magda Candle of the Egyptian Center for Economic Studies says without much oil and with 7,000 years of history to market, Egypt is uniquely dependent on tourist dollars, not to mention euros and yen. They support 5 million jobs, 20% of the economy. Candle says the tourism sector needs stability and for the tanks to come off the streets. Problem is, with Libya next door, this is an increasingly tough tourism neighborhood.
The biggest effect of the crisis on Egypt from an economic point of view is the loss of tourism income, which is estimated over $1 billion a year.
Egyptians are working hard to lure tourists back.
They're going to view this, I don't want to be on a plane crossing the Atlantic or crossing the Mediterranean to go to Egypt.
A group of young people who participated in the revolution decided to print their own ID cards and stamp them National Museum Youth. Now they're painting the cast iron grillwork outside the Egyptian Museum.
We paint gates and pavements, and we sweep the floors and the ground.
Why are you painting here?
To make our museum beautiful and regain its rank among people again.
And at last Friday's rally in Tahrir Square, as people sang the national anthem, a man held a sign reading, "Tourism, now better. Come to Egypt. World spot amended." The English isn't great, but the sentiment's clear. This is a new Egypt. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Moving a little farther to the north and east, the world's largest retailer has abandoned Russia. Walmart never actually opened a store there, but it did open an office in Moscow with public plans to expand. Reporter Peter Van Dyke has more.
Russia is one of the fastest-growing retail markets in the world. But for many U.S. companies, it's hard to start fresh here. Instead, multinationals buy an existing local company and grow it. PepsiCo just spent billions of dollars to buy the largest Russian milk and juice producer. That's what Walmart wanted to do, but Kopeka, a chain named after the Russian word for penny, was just sold to a local competitor instead. Natalia Zagozdina is an investment banker at Renaissance Capital.
And I think they realized that organically the next 2 years will not offer them a lot of opportunity to open. They just have nothing to buy.
In a few years, she says, Walmart will probably be back. Russia is just growing too fast. After all, Walmart has successfully broken into the other big emerging markets of Brazil, India, and China. For now, though, Russia is a brick too far. In Moscow, I'm Peter Van Dyke for Marketplace.
Let's do the numbers. Well, markets around the world are mixed at the moment. The price of oil is up about a buck today. In trading, gas prices here in this country are up 4% in the last week. And they're usually lowest this time of year. Wall Street Friday, the Dow rose 0.5%, 61 points to close at 12,130.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Allianz, providing investment, insurance, and retirement solutions through its affiliated companies in the U.S. since 1896. AllianzUSA.com. By Chevrolet, maker of the new Volt, which plugs in anywhere and goes everywhere. Available in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com.
and by Constant Contact Email Marketing, providing small businesses and nonprofits with personal coaches to help them succeed. ConstantContact.com.
At the Oscars last night in Hollywood, The King's Speech took home the Best Picture trophy and three others, including for lead actor Colin Firth. But back home in Britain, before the movie was made, the idea didn't get a lot of funding bites and relied in part on money from a government program to grow the film industry in the UK. But as the British government trimmed spending, that program got put on the chopping block. Christopher Worth is with us now from London with the latest. Good morning, Christopher.
Good morning.
Are film buffs in the UK celebrating this?
Yes, they are. This is a film that costs about $13 million and will most likely go over $300 million at the box office. But at the same time, the British are mourning the loss of the public body that was brave enough to invest in the movie back when the others didn't want to. Because the budget cuts, the UK Film Council will be no more in just another month's time. I spoke with Angus Finney at the Cass Business School.
Frankly, axing the UK Film Council, which ironically has now coincided with a mega hit, does make the government look pretty foolish.
Are there any plans, Christopher, to use the success of the film as a way to, I don't know, get the funding back?
Well, the UK Film Council could make close to $20 million on its investment. I mean, that money will now go to the British Film Institute, which is now responsible for investing in films. But the other irony is the cost of winding down the Film Council is estimated at about $20 million.
Huh. All right. Christopher Worth in London. Christopher, thanks.
Hey, thanks, Steve.
And finally, it's Girl Scout cookie season again. But this year, there's at least one place you won't be able to buy your do-si-dos. In front of the Juliet Lowe House in Savannah, Georgia. Lowe is the founder of the Girl Scouts, and it's her historic home. The city last year put the kibosh on selling cookies there because it violates a selling things on sidewalks ordinance. But that doesn't mean you won't get the hard sell from family members and coworkers. So, yes, you're still on the hook. Hey, check us out online at marketplace.org. You can share your thoughts with us there. What kind of Girl Scout cookies do you like? And follow me on Twitter at Radio Chio. I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Morning Report. This is APM, American Public Media.
5 years ago, Arizona was doing pretty well. The state budget was up and so was spending, but you know what they say.
State policymakers sometimes forget to realize that the economy goes up and down. When you're at the bottom of a deep hole, you need a ladder to climb out.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. How the recession buried Arizona's budget. That's next time on Marketplace from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.